On the other end of the spectrum, a guy who is from Winnipeg, has nothing new to report. No, hasn't put out a record since before the Waylon Jennies were born. Was a big star, and now he's hiding out somewhere. We're very pleased to be joined by now the somewhat embarrassed Jeffrey Hatcher.
I thought Monty Hall was going to be the end of that sentence.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Very pleased to see you here. Now, I mean, for the folks that that maybe don't know about some of your early work when you were in Winnipeg, name some of the bands you were in. Talk a bit about whatever you can remember and tell people about publicly.
Okay. Well, I first started playing a long time ago, so it's best if I don't tell you everything. It's just too long. But the first band I played in was the Fuse. And I just walked past the multi-purpose room where we played many socials, and I got quite nostalgic there because I haven't been in this building, I don't think, since then, since like 1980, 81 or so. The Fuse was my first band with my brothers Don and Paul and Dave Briggs. And I think, in fact, the first radio interview I ever did was Dave Briggs and me with Howard Manshine at the U of M radio station.
Very nice.
And I can't remember what it was called then. Yeah, it wasn't UMFM.
No.
I think it was, I really can't remember now. And what was UMZU?
Well, this is still, still in UMZU.
This is still the student union.
Yeah.
It's been ages since I was in this building. But that was the first band, the Fuse. And we had an EP back in those days, and Howard played that. And that was our first interview. And we were 2 feet away from the mic, then 2 inches away from the mic, and then two feet away. And
yeah, that's still the way you have to do it here, actually.
Well, people wave their hands at me so much now.
Yeah.
No, closer, farther away. Shut up. We're done. And when that band finished, we regrouped in Toronto about a year later, the Fuse. Renamed ourselves the Six, S-I-X.
Right.
And we stayed in that format, and we played for about a year and a half that band lasted. And we used to come to, because it was impossible to work in Toronto, this is the bizarre thing, we were all living in Toronto.
Yeah.
All the bands were playing like once a month, and we were used to playing six nights a week.
Yeah.
You know, the competition was so fierce, and they didn't have the hotel pub scene that we had here up until, I don't know, somewhere in the 80s it started to peter out. But that was the circuit. All the bands played the hotel pubs. So there we were in Toronto not working. So we used to come to Winnipeg and play for 4 weeks or so and play like every night and two shows a day or sometimes. We'd play, you know, someplace in the afternoon and then come here at night.
Yeah.
Anyway, and go back to Toronto. And with the money we'd made here, we'd go to New York and play at clubs there at dates we'd set up trying to impress people to sign us. And Stu Reed will come into the story somewhere in there. Or maybe we'll come back to Stu.
Yeah, okay.
And so just to jump ahead, then Dave Briggs left and went to school.
Right.
And for a whole year, I had no band, and I was just kicking around writing songs. And then my brothers who had moved back to Winnipeg, returned to Toronto, and I said, well, let's do this for one more year, and as long as it's fun, we'll keep going. It actually wasn't fun at all for a lot of the time, but they agreed anyway. And so we were the big beat then, and it was the three of us and a variety of bass players, keyboard players, and my songs and Dave Briggs' songs and eventually Brother Don's songs as well. And we played until 1990.
Now, this is sort of, sorry, I don't mean to cut in, but
anytime.
This is sort of where you first came to my attention was with, you had a great record called Cross Our Hearts, as I recall.
Cross Our Hearts was,
had a minor hit as far as Canadian songs go with the man who would be king.
I still run into people who I don't know the song.
That's a fantastic
song. So that tells me something.
That's terrific. So
it was a good
one. Was that sort of, at that time, sort of a pinnacle? Was that band bigger than the Fuse and the Six, or was it just?
Yeah, it was better known. We were well enough known that we could tour the country and pull an audience in anywhere we went.
Right.
You know, and we never went up to the next level, whatever the next level is. There's several levels above and several below, so they're not that well defined. But eventually, we stopped in 1990. But we were at it for about 4 years, I think. In 1990, I went to Vancouver.
Right.
And thought I might not play again, but in the meantime, I wasn't sure what I was going to do. Something musical, I hoped.
Now, why would you consider at that time not playing anymore? Were you just tired of sort of grinding it out and not reaching those upper levels, or?
Well, my goal was never to, like, fame was never our goal. Like, we thought that would be a great byproduct. Not so much being personally famous, but as having our music heard other places. We really had, I think, modest enough sized egos that we were fine with. If the music gets well known, excellent. And if people recognize our face, well, okay, we can deal with that. That wasn't like the pot at the end of the rainbow for us. But the reason I considered doing something outside of the music business was because I'd been doing it for about 14 years, I think, at that point, 14, 15 years. And so much of the music business is not music, it's business. And anybody will tell you that you have to put up with so much stuff that is not fun in order to do the 2 hours that you love to do. That I thought, oh, do I want to do this again?
Yeah.
So I considered not doing it again. And I looked around for other things to do with a musical bent to them. And one of them was music therapy. A friend of mine had a son with autism who had a private music therapist, and I'd never heard of this. Art therapy I'd heard about. Music therapy I didn't know anything about. So I called this woman, who's now a colleague of mine, and I asked her a lot about it. Like, what is it? What do you do? What do people do? How many of them are there? Right. Where do you go to school for this? Anyway, she gave me a lot of information that I kept under my hat for a few more years. Because in the meantime, I had joined... I thought I'll find a band to play bass or guitar in to earn a living while I decide what I want to do. And so I found Billy Cowsill's outfit called it was just the Billy Cowsill band, really.
Right.
They called it the Dead Guys Set. Billy's still not with us because I'd love to haul him in here and have him tell you a story or two. But I joined them. Larry Wanigas, who managed Katie Lang for a long time, for ages, and eventually managed the Blue Shadows, which was our band. He was kind of working with Billy at the time. And I got to town, and I knew Larry because the Fuse had toured the country, and we'd met Larry, who was booking bands at University of Alberta in Edmonton.
Yeah.
And so I looked him up and said, I'm interested in trying out auditioning for Billy's band whenever his bass player dies or something. And Larry said, oh, the Dead Guys. You want to play the Dead Guys set? And I said, well, sure, yeah, because I'd seen them play. And I knew all the tunes. It was all, I hadn't played them with a band before, but I knew all the songs.
Now, were you familiar with Billy's career, being in the Cowsills? And
that's all I knew. And I knew that he'd end up in Canada. Because John Mackey, fellow Winnipegger John Mackey, who writes for the Vancouver Sun, he had told me years ago when I was in Toronto, oh, you should move out here and look up this Billy Cowsill guy. Play guitar for him. You guys would be great. And honestly, that was like 1982. So here we are in 1991, and I was trying to do that. And I talked to, get this, I was speaking with Danny Cassavant. Stop me if this gets too long.
But no.
Danny Cassavant, Winnipeg guitarist, living in Vancouver. Danny, for all the old timers, was Graham Shaw's guitarist, as well as whatever career he had before and after that. And I had just got a gig at the Commodore opening as a solo act, opening for Roseanne Cash, who was playing the Commodore. And I needed a 12-string acoustic guitar that I did not own, but I needed that for the show. I didn't have one.
Yeah.
I called Danny and asked him, could he vouch for me at a local music store, because they didn't know me, I just got to town, and could he sort of sign for me while I rented this guitar for the night? So he did that, and he agreed to that, and he also told me that he was leaving Billy's band. He was playing a couple more nights. He was Billy's guitarist at the time. And he said he was leaving after this weekend's gig or whatever. So I called Larry Wanix and said, I heard Danny's leaving the band, can you get me an audition with the guys? And so I did that at a local band, at a local pub, and got the job, and about a year later we were writing our own songs, and that was the Blue Shadows, and that was the last band I was in, sort of. After the Blue Shadows finished, I played for another year with a band called the Sugar Beats, BEATS, with Wendy Bird, a wonderful Vancouver singer that I hope you get to hear one day. Maybe if you bring me back one day, I'll bring in some recorded stuff that she and I have done.
Well, believe me when I say you can come back any old time you want, for Thank one you. Thing. But okay, now the Blue Shadows, I mean, a lot of people now look back and realize how amazing that band was. It seemed like maybe you guys were ahead of your time. Like, if that band started up now or even a few years ago, don't you think things would have been different? Or
At another time, everything would be different for everybody. It's true. It's true that every couple of years goes by where I see some niche we might have fit into.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't available in 1993. Maybe that's true, but at the same time, I think that being ahead or behind your time, and no one ever compliments you for being behind your time. But but the idea of being like ahead of your time, I think the time, your times create you. Whatever is happening for you at the time.
Yeah.
So the idea of being ahead of your time, it can't really work. And you can't predict the future anyway. But it's hard to jump ahead 2 years and it's impossible to jump ahead 2 years. But because everybody's a product of their environment. Yeah, yeah. You know, the Blue Shadows were what they were because of where it was and when it was.
Right.
And I do appreciate the idea that you can look back and say, wow, this was sounding like this before people were.
Yeah.
Which wasn't exactly true for our band, but in a couple of ways I can see why people would say that. And at the same time, you kind of grow out of the soil your feet are in the end.
Right. I mean, is there one band that you look back on as sort of being the one you're most proud of, or are you just proud of all the different ones? For
well, in different ways, I'm proud of them all. Really, all for different reasons.
Yeah.
The Fuse was like our teenage band, you know,
right.
And even though we played until we were like 22 or so, we went at it really hard for about 4 years.
Yeah.
And I was really proud of what we did, given the limited resources that the teenagers have, and also in such a what's the opposite of multimedia? Like the times we have now with you are plugged in now, like to the rest of the world, like you never were before,
right.
And with our first band, The Fuse, this is like 1977. You know, we're talking about 1977, 78 when we really got going, and we were in Winnipeg, which feels more like an international city now, but then it felt like Yellowknife.
Right.
If you ever went to New York or Los Angeles and came back, you thought, oh man, this is so far from everywhere. But it doesn't feel like that now.
Right.
You know, it feels more like a somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
To be some distance from than it ever did. So I was happy with the six as well, because it was kind of like the Fuse grown up. The music got more mature. We kept writing, and I thought it got more mature. The Big Beat, I had mixed feelings about the Big Beat always, because I was the front man by default, and I always wanted to be one of a two or three headed at the front of the stage thing, you know, enterprise. And that band wasn't, and I wasn't comfortable being front person. I was still proud of the music we created, because we were pretty good. We grew to be pretty good editors.
Okay.
You know, we'd look through the millions of cover songs that we knew.
Yeah.
Or let's say hundreds anyway, but we knew tons of songs. And we really could be quite savage editors and say, no, 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 yeah, I think this, yes, yes, yes. No, 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 that's not, it's just not going to work for this band at this time. And with our own songs that we wrote, we did the same thing too. So I was pretty happy with the, when it finally got distilled down to the Cross Our Hearts album, and the next album, which I should bring in, and which was never released, which I think was at least as good as Cross Our Hearts, really. Dan Donahue produced it here in Winnipeg in the spring, winter of 1990. And that's, How Are You Tomorrow, I think is the title we settled on, and it was never released. Anyway, and the Blue Shadows, I was very happy with the Blue Shadows too, and proud of them in different ways too. It was like me really growing up. You know, I started the band in my mid-30s, late-30s, started playing with the band. So I was pretty well on my way. I knew what I could do and what I couldn't do, and I had my feet were pretty well planted on the ground, I think, you know, as far as, you know, emotional maturity went, and I was really happy with the stuff we did with Billy, because he was as he used to tell me, he was like a Clydesdale pulling his sorry ass and his career across the landscape for years, he said. Just playing the bars, not interested in writing his own songs. Really, he'd write a song every couple of years, and then he got really excited by the newcomer. He was 10 years older than me, the new guy in town, and it got him excited about writing songs, and it really got him excited about performing again. Although I have to say, he really always gave it.
Yeah.
Every night,
yeah.
even when he was playing in the smoky places with 12 people in there.
Yeah.
So all the bands I was in, it all seems like one band really.
Yeah.
With about 12 different people with a core of Dave Briggs and my brothers.
Right. Now, of course, Billy just recently passed, and I guess what I read, and you can tell me whether this is true or not, but you guys hadn't spoken for a long time, and then you got to go visit him shortly before he died.
We hadn't talked for almost exactly 10 years.
Right.
And it wasn't because we parted on bad terms, really. If he was here, he'd be happy. He'd be comfortable with me saying that the band broke up because he wasn't doing really well,
right?
Emotionally,
right.
Physically, in a lot of ways.
Right.
The band, and we didn't even break up. We stopped playing,
right.
Really. Like JB Johnson, my dear friend, who was the drummer in that band, he told our management one day, I'm not quitting. I'm just stopping playing. You know, like I'm gone now.
Yeah.
I can't do it anymore. And we did the same thing too. Billy and I, we just talked about, okay, we didn't even talk about why. We just said, okay, March, we have these dates in March of 97, I guess it was. And okay, that'll be the end, you know. And we played New Year's Eve in Calgary, and we had dates in January, February booked, and we didn't really talk about how hard this had been and why it should stop and all that kind of the emotional, painful sort of stuff. We just agreed that it's going to end here.
Yeah.
And it just did. It just stopped. No more gigs. No more phone calls. And he left town soon after that. And my personal feeling was that I would have loved to have been in touch with him, because we did get along very well, almost all the time. And I thought I would make him uncomfortable by getting in touch with him, because I think he felt that the band broke up because of him.
Right.
And there was, you know, there's a lot of truth in that. And it wasn't his willful doing. It was, the train was out of control. the horse had left the barn.
Yeah. You know?
And in the last couple of years, I'd heard from a variety of people. He was in Calgary now. And I have friends in Calgary who would let me know that, oh, they saw him play here, they saw him play there. And I'm friends with Tim Leacock, who was in Billy's last band, The Codependents. The rest of the guys I didn't know. I just met them in Vancouver, actually, at this memorial show I can tell you about in April. That happened in April. But that was how I kept my ear to the ground to see how he was doing, because I was interested in how he was doing.
Yeah.
And when I heard he was doing really badly, I thought, oh, I got to talk to him. And you know how everybody does this. Oh, I've got to do this. I got to do this. Then you think, well, maybe I should. And before you know it, 6 months has gone by, and then 18 months has gone by, and it's ridiculous, you know? And finally I heard he was in really bad health. He'd had a collapsed lung.
Yeah.
He was walking with a cane.
Yeah.
He couldn't perform anymore. And it really sounded dreadful. And then his brother died. Then Barry died in Katrina.
Right.
Barry, who lived off and on, I think, in New Orleans. I didn't know Barry. I've only ever met Billy's sister, Susan.
Okay, yeah.
When the Blue Shadows played in Austin, we met Susan. Otherwise, I didn't know his family. Anyway, Barry died, and I thought, well, this is messed up. I can't not talk to him now. So I got his phone number, and I called him a couple of times, and I got an answering machine that didn't have his voice on it, so I wasn't sure I had the right number. So I thought, I'll write him a letter. So I did him a handwritten letter, because I knew he'd like that. Billy was a really old-timey kind of guy. So I handwrote a letter, special delivered it, so he'd get it soon after his brother had died. And he phoned me up about a week later. And we had a great, a lovely, long chat. And I didn't recognize his voice right away, because he really was in rough shape. And he really had a really wispy sound, like a really old man's kind of sound in his voice. And he told me that he hadn't performed for at least a couple months. And we talked a bit about his health, but about other things too, you know. And it was very nice. I thought he wouldn't last long after that.
Yeah.
He wouldn't live long after that after we talked. And I told him I loved him, and I'll be in touch, you know.
Yeah.
And then I think he died about a week or 10 days after that.
Wow.
I found out from my good friend Paul Canton, another ex-Winnipegger, a great music writer, Paul Canton, who's working for the Health Council of Canada right now. He's in Toronto. He phoned me and let me know.
And we were talking a little bit off the air. There are some talks about re-releasing some of that Blue Shadow stuff finally.
I've heard that the latest I've heard is that Larry Wanagas, who was our manager back then, and who also ran the record label that signed us, and then he licensed our material to Sony. He's interested in re-releasing the material, and probably going to start with the first album with some extra tracks on it.
Right.
Because the Blue Shadows recorded a lot of songs. The two albums we did release had about 24 songs maybe on them, 23 or 4 songs, and we recorded about 40 more that we wrote, and another dozen cover of our favorite covers. Stuff that Billy, it was like me and Billy, for covers, me and Billy used to just go deep into our like chestnut sack, you know. We'd go back into like Arthur Alexander songs and old R&B songs and songs that most people actually, like the true music lovers, the really obscure stuff that we loved, and we used to be really, we would excite each other with the stuff that we knew about obscure material, like Arthur Alexander's tunes.
Yeah.
Usually only songwriters know guys like that, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, so there's a lot of material out there that's in good shape, we've been discovering over the last few months. So I couldn't tell you when, but eventually this stuff will come out. It may be another good excuse to come in.
Yeah, well,
and talk about it.
You don't need an excuse, like I keep saying. I mean it. All right, so talk a bit about your life after being a performing musician.
Well, once I'd finished the year of playing with, I actually played with Barry Muir, J.B. Johnson, the Blue Shadows rhythm section, and Wendy Bird. We didn't do Blue Shadows material, although we did a couple of tunes, a couple of Blue Shadows songs. After that year of playing with that group, I went back to school, and I had a pretty good idea that the music therapy thing was going to work because I'd gone to an open house at Capilano College, and it really seemed like a good way. This is the way I put it now. It seemed like a good way for me to do something with my musical experience and my musical interests, but also to add the interests I have in psychology and sociology and all the kind of stuff you can't really. The interest right. you can't really satisfy if you're hanging around the music business all the time.
That's a different kind of psychology, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a different level. And so I did that, and I thought, I'm insane. You know, I was 39. I was taking like first year university English and psychology at Langara College, which is a college you probably wouldn't know, but Langara, it's a college mostly with kids straight out of high school. So it was extra funny for me. I was 39. So I thought I was like surrounded by 12-year-olds. But by the following year, I'd finished enough prerequisites that I was in the music therapy program itself. After 2 years of prerequisite courses, I was doing the music therapy third and fourth year, and I was with adults again. And so it's a 4-year bachelor program, music therapy. And I went to Capilano College in North Vancouver. And when it was finished, I started working immediately at an HIV and AIDS day center and residence called the Dr. Peter Center in Vancouver, where I had done a practicum and my internship in the music therapy program.
Right.
And with those clients, I mean, I was doing a lot of different things with the clients. But one of the things I did a lot of was songwriting. And this was the most fun for me. It wasn't just writing songs. It was writing song. Therapeutic songwriting is really what I had to call it, because we were looking at the songs people wrote. And using that for like emotional exploration,
right?
Or let's say exploration of their emotional life, in a way that they hadn't done before, because most people, and maybe only one of the four of us has been to a therapist, but most of the audience at home has been, and anybody who has been to a therapist can probably tell you that one of the dangers of verbal psychotherapy, which is what so much of it is, it's verbal interaction with a psychologist or counselor. One of the problems is being stuck in the same rut.
Not the same emotional rut,
you're saying the same things about the same issues. And you're drawing the same conclusions. Or you keep slipping off the road into the ditch, into this groove. And one of the great things about creative arts therapies is it can give people a chance to shake that up and look at it from a different part of the point of view and from a different using a different part of their brain, even.
Right.
Because the verbal, the speaking and the singing, for example, sides of the brain are exclusive. Right. One is left and one is right. When you're doing one, the other side is not humming along like it did. I'd like to do a study sometime on rappers, you know, just to see to see if the parts of the brain that light up when you're singing are lighting up, or is all the activity happening in the verbal part of the brain, because they're speaking musically but they're not singing. And I think the real rappers, the ones who don't use melodic contours like we're used to, I think they'd be pretty insistent that no, they're not singing, they're rapping.
Right.
And if you said, well, is it more singing or talking, I think they'd fall, the graph would fall closer to talking in their opinion, and I think they're right. I'd love to know what's happening there. Anyway, I did a lot of songwriting with clients, as well as, you know, improvisation and musical improvs and teaching people instruments, very rudimentary stuff on instruments, and then having them really go to town with it, and then doing emotional exploration after that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the therapeutic value is in the examining of what you've just done.
Right.
And there's also value in what you are doing while you're doing it. Banging away, crashing away, percussion or piano improvisation, whatever you're doing. There's something nice happening while you're doing that too, because you're engaged, you're occupied.
Right.
Something that's not usually humming in your body is. But the real work happens afterwards as you look back at it and then build on it. So I worked there until I left town. My partner and I had planned for about 10 years or so to get back here, to move back here.
Okay.
Maybe for about 8 years or so. And school got in the way of that. And then I got into a grad program at Simon Fraser University in counseling psychology.
Right.
So that slowed us down for 3 more years. And she was quite busy in Vancouver too. She's a visual artist. And she had a lot of stuff going on there at the time. So life just slowed us down. But we finally got here in December. And but before I moved, I arranged for a job for myself at an agency called New Directions. It's a very big and old agency. It used to be the Children's Home of Winnipeg, if you ever heard of that. Mm-hmm. It was like a huge orphanage at one time. It might have been the biggest one in town. I don't know the history like some of my colleagues do. But anyway, in the 90s, I think it became New Directions. And they have a lot of programs. One of them is a youth program. And that's where I got a job as clinical worker, like clinician / music therapist. I was able to create the music therapy position there. They needed a clinician, a counselor, really, to do work with the young people there. But I think the fact that I had music therapy experience and could explain it to them, because they didn't know a lot about it, got me the job. And that's where I'm working now. And I'm working in a program that is called Project VIP. It was created out of... there's a program called TRY there, Training Resources for Youth, TRY, that's been running for almost 30 years. And last year, when there were three... You guys would know this better than me. But there were three or four really high-profile youth deaths,
yes.
You know, gang-related
yeah.
stuff.
Yeah.
And one boy in particular was very close to the program. And he died trying to get out of the gangs,
right.
trying to leave the gang world. And they didn't let him. And that upset my program manager enough that she really wanted to do something special for other young people in that position. And there are a lot of them downtown, especially downtown. And so Project VIP was created with funding from Justice Canada, I think Manitoba Health, and Manitoba Justice. I think that's the three primary funders.
Yeah.
So I started working there in January, and we started getting referrals from the Adolescent Treatment Center and from the Manitoba Youth Center. And more than half of the young people that were referred to us had fetal alcohol syndrome, had FAS, which I can briefly kind of sum up for the listeners at home, if you think I should. Most
sure,
people know
yeah.
that it exists,
yeah.
FAS. A lot don't know about it. Really briefly, it's FASD, as it's called, known now, fetal
right.
alcohol spectrum disorders. And there's a lot of different diagnoses that
yeah.
that fall under that umbrella. So people don't get diagnosed with FASD. They get diagnosed with FAS, partial FAS, ARND, which is alcohol-related neurodevelopmental disorder, a variety of things. But the FASDs, the disorders, is a big umbrella under which they all fall. And it's caused by prenatal exposure to alcohol.
Right.
So the mom has to have drunk alcohol. The amount necessary seems to be dropping all the time.
Yeah.
They talk about now binge drinking being a primary factor in this source of this cause of mental retardation, which is what it is.
Right.
Binge drinking is defined now as four drinks on one occasion. And who does? And if anybody yeah. drinks, who doesn't drink more
yeah.
than four drinks? And when you put that together with the incredible percentage of women who are pregnant for several weeks,
sometimes
months without
yeah,
knowing it.
Yeah.
Not every pregnancy is planned or
yeah, yeah.
or anticipated, of
yeah.
course. So that puts a lot of weight on FAS being able to take hold. So there are many people with FAS, and it's commonly thought that people with FAS, fetal alcohol syndrome, have distinctive facial characteristics, and because people have learned that since through the 80s and the 90s,
yeah, yeah.
But it's we're finding now that it's actually a small percentage of people who do.
Okay.
Yeah, and so longtime experts in the field often say, I wish these kids looked as impaired as they are.
Yeah, yeah.
Because people wouldn't expect so much from
yeah,
them. They would,
yeah.
and they wouldn't keep getting kicked from grade to grade in the school system and being labeled as bad kids, especially
yeah.
the boys.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, time and again, when it comes to not understanding anything in the classroom and being overstimulated and not, just not getting anything, everybody seems to be talking too fast. You
yeah.
can't hold any,
yeah.
you can't, no short-term memory. The kids, they'd rather act, and I would too, they'd rather act bad than
mm-hmm.
be thought of as stupid.
Mm-hmm.
So the boys especially act up and act out and eventually get kicked out of school. When I was in Vancouver, when we left town to move back here, I was partway through my second year of running an FAS program in a local high school. There are very few of them around that we've been able to find where the classrooms are designed specifically for FAS kids. And Winnipeg could use a good couple of thousand
for sure,
spaces yeah. like yeah. that. And but it has David Livingston School and Shaughnessy Park School, in the both in the North End.
Yeah.
And they only go kindergarten to eighth grade right now. Last fall, they were hoping to start the first high school that was specifically designed classrooms for FAS kids. Those two schools, by the way, aren't all FAS. They have each of them has two or, pardon me, each has three classrooms mm-hmm. dedicated to FAS kids of various ages. This. And I forget what the definitions of school now are. There's like junior high has gone. Now there's middle school. Yes, is there?
Yeah, I got middle. School
middle. Class. Yeah. So there's those three. Up until high school, and they were hoping that a high school thing would open last fall, and it should have for sure, but it didn't happen. So some of the first kids to graduate out of that program, including some who'd gone from kindergarten through grade 8 with special FASD programming, and who were doing really well, and I've met a lot of those kids too,
yeah.
doing beautifully well, compared to the kids in Vancouver who were in their first or second or third year of FAS programming. So they'd been kicked through the school system, so they were 13, 14,
yeah.
and now they're... And they were just wild,
yeah,
for the first few months of that programming.
Can you put this in perspective at all? I mean, I'm a teacher, and I see these kids every yeah. day. I mean, there are a lot of them out there. Do you have any stats or numbers for how many kids are affected by this, or any idea how prevalent it really is?
I think people don't. You know, I mean, I've seen statistics all for years. I've been reading statistics from all over the place, Canada and the States, and. And they vary incredibly widely because
yeah.
so few kids are diagnosed.
Right.
So few are assessed. More and more are assessed all the time, but
right.
more keep coming along too. I've seen it as high as 9% and 10% of the population.
Yeah.
There have been a couple of reserves in the north where people have done a study and they didn't have the resources to assess everybody.
Yeah. yeah.
But they figured that including adults and children, people of all ages, that the percentages were into two digits almost.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've also seen like 0.9% of the, between from 0.9% of the, not 9%, but 0.9% up to, you know,
right.
6% of the population. It's quite wildly varying.
So, all right. So obviously it's a big problem. Now, what kinds of things do you do in your program to help these kids and what kind of, I guess, effects are we seeing? Like what exactly does your job entail helping these kids?
Well, I'm not alone there, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
There's two case managers there, and very soon there are at least three more staff coming on board, family therapy people and teachers who are trained in special needs such as that.
Yeah.
And then myself as the clinician and music therapist. So what I'm doing now actually is it's sort of like treading water for a couple of weeks because the real programming really starts in July when we get a bigger space and more staff. But for the moment, what I do is I spend the morning with there are three young people in my program right now, and depending on how many of them show up,
yeah,
on any one day, my good friend John, who's listening tonight, is a very faithful attendee of the program. And we do a variety of structured musical activities and social and life skills things as well. Just the two of us. The programming will expand, as I say, into afternoon programming later in the summer, and eventually we'll be looking at supervised and modified job placements for the young people as well.
Okay. Now, in case you joined us late, this is Jeff Hatcher, by the way, and talk a bit about why you're here. What the event is that we are.
Well, I'm here to invite the public to. We've invited hundreds of healthcare professionals and legal people all over the city and outside the city to this already. So we're inviting the public now to a fundraising party we're having for Project VIP, and it's happening at on Thursday of next week from noon till about 2 o'clock probably. And it's a lunchtime thing. It's no tickets to buy, no admission price. The various things will be for sale there. Lunch will be for purchase as well. A silent auction, and there'll be a couple of speeches and a presentation. And Brother Don is going to come down with me, and we'll play some tunes.
Excellent.
He's free in the afternoon. He's made himself available, so we're going to do that. I think there's one or two other musicians as well. And I think we'll pull in a couple of passers-by as well to shake a tambourine. It's happening at the New Directions office, which is at 400 Portage Avenue. is it Colony there, or is it Isabel there? Right at the corner. Kitty Corner to the Bay. What is that? Is it Colony there still?
It's right. It's in the Rice Financial Building, right?
It's in the Rice. That's easier than anything else. Yeah. The Rice Financial Building. Come in the front door and go up to the sixth floor. That's the easiest thing you can do.
Yep.
And people will direct you to where the party's going
to
be.
It's right next to the University of Winnipeg.
Right across from the east wall of the U of W.
Yeah, yeah.
And watch for the big Rice word on that eighth or whatever floor building that is. That's where it's happening.
So what am I going to this for? Like, what is the goal of this event? If there's no tickets, obviously, I mean, you are raising money, but it seems to me that that's not the prime concern, or?
Well, if we weren't raising money, it would be a different sort of event. But
right.
there is another educational component to it, which is that we want the public to know that the program exists,
right?
What it's doing, who it's serving, and how tiny it is,
right?
People need to know that we're very excited about what we're doing.
Well, it's an amazing thing, and like I said, I see these kids all the time, and if there was a way that I could help them in a way that you can, then I think it's an amazing thing. So,
well, I think we're seeing great results now, and when I say tiny, it's because we have to keep it small.
Yeah.
As you can appreciate, in the education system, young people like that, they pretty well need one-to-one attention.
Well, that's the problem, is that they're thrown in a class with everybody else, and that's why they have so much trouble, right?
Yeah, they need that for the day and for the rest of their life.
Yeah.
They need a lot of assistance.
Yeah.
They don't look as challenged as they are.
Right.
And when support is given to them, unlike with a lot of other disabilities, where often you can say, okay, that's enough, or that worked,
yeah,
or improvement has been noted, and you can gradually pull it away. This can't happen with our young people,
right,
or anybody of any age with FAS. It's a lifelong, insults to the brain,
right,
that has happened. It's a lifelong thing that they're dealing with, and our trick is to find the strengths and maximize them, and find exactly what they need, and change our approaches to dealing with them.
Right.
They're 10-second people in a 1-second world, as someone said. We have to slow life down to manageable bites for them.
Right.
They're capable of incredible things when we can help that come through.
Yeah, absolutely. So where, like, obviously you want some of my money at this event, which is a good thing. Where does my money go? How does it help the program? Is it just
the money is going to go directly into the hiring of staff for the program. We have space, and we have a starting group of staff.
Excellent.
And this is going to go directly to getting closer to the one-on-one attention that they need.
Well, it sounds like a fantastic event, and I hope people come out. Mention it again.
It's called the Very Important Party, VIP, for Project VIP at New Directions, and it's happening next Thursday, which is, help me, it's the 22nd. Is there a calendar in the house? 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th.
Yes, that's right.
7 days from today, the 15th. Thursday, June 22nd at noon. And it's happening at our offices, which is in the Rice Financial Building at Portage and Colony. Just come in the front door, come up to the sixth floor, and say you're here for the VIP, or you're here for the party, and they'll take you out to where it's happening.
Excellent.
Which is the top of the parking garage.
And can I look at my webmasters and say we can put this on the web somewhere, so folks can, if they don't
absolutely
get all the details now, we can get those up on the websites.
Oh,
and
we
stuff?
Can. Oh, if you can, please.
All right. One last question, just on a selfish note. Do we ever see you back doing music? Do you ever do a show now and again to get the bug? Do you want to go out and?
You'd think I would get the bug, since there's no smoke in these damn places anymore.
Yeah.
After 100 years of playing in smoky places, even after stopping smoking myself. I do get the bug once in a while, and I have I do play once in a while if someone asks me and it sounds like fun, or if I stumble into it, like Don and the boys, the Hatcher Briggs band, they play once in a while, and they, you know,
and now that's the big talk. Every time they play, it's like, is Jeff going to join them?
Well, I that is very sweet. I was in town a couple January of last year, I think, and something happened, and I had to stay over for a couple more nights.
Yeah.
And so it overlapped with them playing there, so I sat in with them. That was very fun.
Yeah.
It's great fun to play. And now that school is all over, and I have some creative, and I can put creativity towards something else besides writing papers and master's theses and all that stuff, I have been writing again in the last couple of years, and I am interested in getting the stuff out. So when that's recorded, I have no interest in chasing a professional music career of the old sort.
Well,
that is going on the road looking for a manager.
That's good though, because then you're doing it for the right reasons. You're doing it on your terms.
It's totally good.
that's an awesome thing.
The reasons are totally honorable, I think. Yeah.
Excellent.
And I'd be very pleased to just give the music away on when I get my website up and running. Just throw it out there.
Well, we are here to help make that happen, however we can. Believe me when I tell you that.
Well, thank you. I will stop by sometime soon. Yeah.
I would love that. It's been a real pleasure chatting with you, and I'll admit publicly what I admitted before. I thought you were coming on Sunday, so I don't have any of your stuff here to play, and I feel like the biggest loser. But on Sunday, I have a show called Tell the Band to Go Home from 2 to 4, and I will play a lot. We'll play.
I hope you find some in the library there.
I've got it all at home.
Of your own stuff.
Yeah, I've got the new Fuse 6 compilation CD, which is fantastic. I've got the Cross Our Hearts record. I've got all the Blue Shadow stuff. So,
and soon you'll have some unreleased stuff.
So play that on Sunday.
I'll make sure you get that.
I would absolutely love that. So we don't have anything of yours, but we do have something from Billy, if that's okay.
Yeah, what do you have?
From a recently released live EP.
Oh, that one, yeah.
That's recorded at the Crystal Ballroom in 1985 with the young Colin James on guitar.
Yeah, Colin was Billy's guitarist just before Danny Kassman was.
And he's in town, when, on Monday?
Monday.
At the X?
He's playing at the X, I think, Colin.
Yeah, something like that.
I saw him at the Billy's Memorial Concert in April at the Railway Club in Vancouver.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So anyways, we'll play something from Billy, and real pleasure and an honor having you here.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
Tom Petty was a feeling mean when he got his tail caught on the seat.